Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. And we are going to be exploring something today that I bet you don't hear on very many programs. Tracking. Yes. Now, we all know about GPS, but what about learning the skill yourself? If you were a kid, maybe you pretended that you were out in the woods and you were trying to find something, and how would you know where the deer went, or would you find a wolf, or how would you track a person? We've all read stories when we were growing up about how the Native Americans did this. Well, actually, this was a skill that many indigenous people cultivated because it was a very significant part of their survival. Well, my guest today, Tamarack Song, is a man who lives this daily, and he teaches it, and his book is utterly fascinating. It has the most wonderful image of a wolf in this ethereal shadow that surrounds it, and then what looks like the hills of Alaska to me. And, of course, that's very meaningful. The book is titled Entering the Mind of the Tracker. Tamarack, you're a man that has a very unique profession. And I think that what you do is so intriguing because it does involve utilizing the mind so much. Now, I want my listeners to know about you that you have done studies of Aboriginal people around the world. You apprenticed yourself, or maybe I should say you were chosen to be an apprentice to elders, and you don't mind living alone in the woods. Is this the way you felt when you were a kid growing up?
Well, you know, Donna, people think from the perspective, from our urban perspectives, that someone going out in the woods is alone, and it's actually the opposite. I felt more alone in the city than I have in the woods. What I've learned from the elders, and especially from direct experience, when I was a kid, my backyard was the woods and the swamps and the fields of central Wisconsin. I grew up in a small farming town. And something the elders, the native elders that I connected with when I started to travel in my late teens and early 20s, impressed upon me right away is that it's not the plants and animals out there, but they already live in a community, a beautiful interactive community, where they are sisters and brothers to each other. And when a human goes out and walks into the woods, he's not walking away from something, he's walking into this community. And if you're open, if you're receptive, if you have good, well-functioning relationship skills, you feel this relationship. So when you hear Native people talking about the plants and the animals being their brothers, they mean it literally, not genetically, of course, but relationally. They live with these plants and animals and the wind and the rocks as though they are brothers and sisters. And that's why almost stereotypical that Native people live in honor and respect for their environment because it's their kin. You live in honor and respect of the people you're close to. It's just natural for them. And it could be for us, too, if we would allow ourselves to just be, to listen, and to become immersed in this circle of life, this circle of relationship.
Now, you have a foreword in your book that is written by Brian Nez. And he says, former shadow wolf, and I was intrigued. I've never heard of this group. And quoting from your book, he's a retired senior member of the legendary shadow wolves, the elite, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Service unit that apprehends drug smugglers crossing the U.S.-Mexican border. And this is, wow, this was something for me. I said, this is incredible. Who knew that there was this group that were carrying forth to apprehend criminals, if you will, and to utilize this in everyday life in this manner. This is phenomenal. And it's comprised, this group is comprised primarily, or actually solely, of American Indian men and women.
Yes.
And I thought, wow.
Yes.
This is phenomenal to know that the women are included in this as well. And Brian is now training, just like you do, tactical tracking units around the world. So your book, just for me, opened up a whole dimension of awareness that far from being a disappearing art, it has been a skill that has been applied in applications that the average individual doesn't even have a clue exists.
Yeah, you know, that's such an important point, Donna. We look at the mythical tracker out there, and we see the shadow wolves and their stories of mystery and intrigue as they're tracking drug smugglers across the U.S.-Mexican border. Fantastic stories. But you know what? All of us are trackers. It's probably the primal human skill. It's what distinguishes us from the other animals. We all track every day. If you have kids, if you keep track of your kids, if you keep track of your finances, you lose your keys and you need to track them down, right?
Mm-hmm.
To get across town, you are tracking. This is an intrinsic skill. It's an intuitive skill that we all have. We just don't recognize it. Most of us don't have it developed to the degree it could be. And one problem with people when they go out in the woods is that they go thinking they don't know anything and they cannot take this skill and apply it when they're in the woods, even though they do very well in town with it. So we're really dumbing ourselves down. We are all trackers, and we have all of the capability of the shadow wolves. All we need to do is apply it and practice it.
There were some very interesting points right at the beginning of the book, complementing what you have just mentioned. And you say we must become identified and aware of the animal within ourselves. And I think most people would shudder when they'd hear that because they have these horrific visions. Well, we're part of the animal kingdom. This is a fact. This is a reality. And you say, to become the animal, we first need to be hungry. An animal hunts to eat, and hunger is its motivation.
Yeah.
And a full belly numbs, for example, and again I'm quoting from your book, a wolf senses and puts the wolf to sleep. While hunger supersensitizes her so she can feel, see, and hear things that otherwise might be missed. And I thought about that when I was reading it, and I said to myself, this is often the way a mother will feel when something happens to the child.
Mm.
Everything goes into this almost, it's a survival factor. What do you do? How are you going to work with it? How are you going to manage the fear that may come up? How do you take that energy and put it into something that is very useful? What are you going to do with it? And I like your comment about the city versus the country type of theory. And there's so much of this that we have disassociated from. And I think it behooves us, and I think your book goes a long way to bringing people in touch with this, behooves us to not be afraid of this fact of life. Why do you think we have become so disassociated?
Boy, that's the long story. In fact, I'm writing another book on that just to answer just that question. It's quite a mystery. It seems as though when we... All of our ancestors were hunter-gatherers at one time. That's all there was. We were nomadic people who moved around. Sometimes we followed the herds of buffalo or wildebeest, depending upon the continent our ancestors lived on. And we were perfectly comfortable with the environment. We knew the means and ends of our existence and the existence of the animals. We were all kin, as I mentioned before. Something happened when we adopted agriculture. We settled down in villages, and all of a sudden, nature became our enemy. we had to fight nature back. We couldn't have the deer and the rabbits coming in to eat our broccoli, right? So we had to fence it off. The plants out there that started growing into our wheat fields and our gardens became weeds, so we had to pull out the weeds. We had to push them back. The trees start sprouting up in our gardens or our pastures, and we have to cut the trees down. We had chickens or pigs. We can't have the lions and tigers eating our chickens and pigs, right? So we had to kill them and fend them off. So nature became our enemy, not by intent at all, but just by circumstance. So we gradually isolated ourselves from the means and ends of our existence. That is the short answer, at least as far as from my perspective. And we are now suffering the repercussions of that. We've alienated ourselves from nature, not because we want to again. If you ask anybody if they have feelings of relationship with nature, just about everybody will say yes. However, we don't really have that visceral connection with nature anymore. So we can have feelings, but it's just a feeling if we can't translate it into real life. And I'm afraid that's our dilemma right now. Otherwise, we would not be exploiting our planet and polluting our planet, our mother planet, as we are.
Well, I think that included in that were a lot of belief systems that felt that when you made nature the enemy, you were then the conqueror, and you were not going to have to be concerned about anything because that was, gee whiz, you didn't have to be concerned. You were the macho energy, if you will. The sad thing is there's so much we have ignored, but that is part of our learning curve, too. And I am delighted that someone like you is bringing forth the wisdom that you have acquired through the years. And I want you to share how you ended up bonding with wolves. I think wolves are one of the most incredible animals around. They are just so intelligent. They have just a significant part in the balance of life. To this day, people really don't understand. And it all started with some pups, and they were 11 days old when you saw them. Tell us your story. It is a beautiful one.
Oh boy. Well, it started even before that. When I was a kid, I was playing outside. I would fantasize about there being wolves in the woods, you know, seeing the shadows of wolves moving through the brush, through the trees. And I'd come up to a den, and I'd think, oh, I wonder if this is a wolf den. Of course, it was much too small for a wolf den. It was probably a fox or a badger den. But to me, with my little imagination, it was a wolf den. So I always had this fascination with wolves. They were a symbol of the majesty of the wilderness and the cleverness and the cunning. And not just that, but wolves are social animals. You know, they live together in family packs, and they're very kind and caring with each other. They raise the pups collectively. When they make kills, they share the kill. They're just, to me, as a child, they were the epitome of what a good functioning family was. And my family of origin wasn't always so functional. Mm-hmm. So I dreamed about being a part of a wolf pack and living that way, living in honor and respect of each other. So when I was in my early 20s, I had a music store, a record shop. And I knew a lot of my customers on a first-name basis. They would come in, and they'd ask what the latest music was, or they wanted to get a hold of a rare recording, and I helped them get it. So I made friends with some, and they got to know me, and we got to know each other socially. And most of my closest friends and good customers knew that I was really into the wilderness, and wolves were a mythical hero of mine, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
One customer came in and said, hey, I was just up north, and I stopped at this little roadside zoo up in the North Woods here. We have a number of little zoos where tourists stop, and they can see some deer and pet the fawns and see raccoons and foxes and all the typical bears, the typical North Woods animals. And he said that he just came back from this one roadside zoo, and they had a pair of wolves that just had pups, and he wasn't happy with the way the wolves were caged. They were just in a little cage, and they were pacing back and forth. And the mother wolf looked pretty ragged, and they just took the pups away from the mother. And he picked up on the fact that they were going to get rid of the pups. So right after work, I gave the owner of the zoo a call, and I hopped in my car the next morning and rode up there. And there to greet me was their two young teenage daughters, and they took me into their bathroom, and in the bathtub there were four little fur balls, four little charcoal-colored fur balls. And
my goodness!
Oh, they were just beautiful. You know how puppies are so adorable.
Oh, they are. They're precious.
Oh boy, wolf puppies are just the same. And they had little blue and pink bows tied around their necks. You know, these were young girls, and they were bottle feeding them. They had adopted them, and it was just a beautiful sight. If you walked in there, you'd never know they were wolf pups. You'd think they were, you know, black lab pups or something from the family dog. And I talked with the owner, and I asked what was going to happen to the pups, and he said, well, they were going away that weekend, and they didn't have anyone to take care of the pups, and they were wanting to sell them. And I asked how much, and he gave me a price for the four, and it was a hefty price. And I thought, well, maybe I'll take two of them, but no, I want to keep the four pups together. They're litter mates, and they ought to grow up together. So I bought all four of them for the price of one. I told him what I was going to do with them. I had this vision of helping to release wolves back into the wilds because they were exterminated here in the North Woods. Mm-hmm. So I brought all four pups home, and we grew up together. As they grew up, they formed their hierarchy, and they allowed me to be a member of the pack. I was the alpha male at first. I was the biggest guy, you know. And,
right.
We had a beautiful pack structure going. We went running through the fields together and frolicking and playing. And eventually one of the males dominated and took the alpha role, and I stepped back and allowed him to do it. I was an honorary wolf, not a real wolf. And it was fine with me just to be a pack member. I had some acreage, and I built a large pen in the backyard that came right up to my back door. So I could join in with the pack whenever I wanted, and they accepted me fully. And I have to say that I grew up with them the same way they grew up with me. I learned so much from them, so much of what came naturally for them, so much of what they had intuitively was slumbering inside me. And being natural and spontaneous with them just helped. I had to be emotionally honest with them. This is probably the biggest gift. You know, with people, I was in my early 20s, and I was struggling with relationships. I was struggling to find my own rhythm in life. And oftentimes, I would not speak my truth with other humans. I felt alienated from them. I didn't feel understood. Much of what young adults go through, I was right there in the middle of it. It did not work for the wolves. They could see right through that. I had to be in the now. I had to express my feelings and live them, because if I didn't, they would call my bluff anyway.
I find your stories and your interaction in the environment with the wolves utterly mesmerizing. Really, I just think they're such an incredible creature, and I've always felt this about them and about so many of the other creatures that live in our world. And in your book, you talk about the various classes that you do and the various experiences that certain people go through, and you do such a wonderful job with it. And part of the aspect of being the teacher is awakening with the students the awareness that they too can become a teacher at some point, but that they have to be awake. And maybe that sounds like a strange word for someone who's listening to the show to hear, but it's paying attention. It's really listening. It's being aware of your surroundings. And you go into dealing with a few of the creatures. You have frogs, you talk about the bears, you talk about turtles, and you talk about the spiders and various creatures. And I loved this different positioning of observation and awareness as how significant all of these forms of life are. Let's talk about your chapter, Romancing the Frog. And I think anybody, when they hear Romancing the Frog, they're going to think of the princess kissing the frog and hoping he's a handsome prince.
Yeah.
Of course, we all know the quote that says, beware, you're going to kiss a lot of toads before you find the prince that you want. I mean,
right.
This is something that's been promoted for years. And, of course, there was an old fable about it and all of that. But tell us about the relationship and the association, why you chose the frog over, let's say, the toad. Why did you specifically choose the frog?
Well, it's partly circumstance. It was just I wanted to choose a story where I could get across the concept of listening, of just being, of getting out of our egos and opening up to what is there around us. We are so conditioned in this culture because we are continually future projecting. We have to be somewhere at a certain time, and we have to achieve a certain something by a certain deadline. We can't be late. We have to squeeze this and this and that into these parameters. So we're continually going from point A to point B. And even though we're not at point B yet, we are there psycho-emotionally. It consumes us. It consumes our consciousness. And we miss everything between point A and point B. Who knows what discoveries there might be there? Who knows how it might enrich our lives? So we keep going from peak experience to peak experience instead of having life be a peak experience, of just being immersed in the now. And that's what I wanted to do with this story. And frogs are so good because they're so visible. Anybody who goes, who has a pond nearby or a ditch or a stream or a lake or goes on vacation, goes near the water, you're probably going to see frogs. And they're so easy to observe. Toads are more creatures of the night. They come out at night to feast on insects and such. But frogs are out in the broad daylight. And Letty, my wife, and I were sitting on the edge of this little pond we have right in our yard here. And the ice was just leaving the pond. The north edge of the pond was thawed out already. The water was open. And we have a frog here called the wood frog. It's a very small frog, maybe 2.5 inches long. And they're the first frogs to come up. The water can be 33 degrees yet. The ice is just off, but there they are popping up. They need to breed quickly because these small woodland ponds up here are ephemeral. They have snow melt in them, and they dry up in 6 or 8 or 10 weeks. So they have to wake up, breed, and the tadpoles need to hatch, grow, and metamorphize into frogs, all within that 6 to 10 weeks. So they waste no time. And that's what the story's about. And it's such a beautiful story because if we think about it in human terms, we watch these frogs, and it's like they wake up, and it's, oh, hi, Sally, you wanna screw? And, you know, they're just right on top of each other, and it's over. And we think, oh, gee, that's very utilitarian. Where's the romance? And the romance is there if we become the frog, if we realize what their lives are like, and if we can immerse ourselves in their time frame and see what's important to them. There is so much that's qualitative there, and that's what the story's about.
You go into bears, you talk about deer, and you mention something that I think is pretty profound. A social animal, which human beings are, social animal has her intelligence centered not in her individual brain, but in the clan consciousness. And, of course, as human beings, we can talk about universal consciousness. We can talk about, you know, cultural consciousness. This is something that people will discuss. But I think when you come from the positioning of looking at the natural world, there are those cellular, genetic pattern. They don't even think about them. It's just there. And it enables them to survive, and it's passed along. The elephants, I think, are just a dramatic demonstration of this and how things are done. And I just think there's so many species that demonstrate this, and you used the deer. And, of course, you talk about the squirrel, but the bear. There are so many people that think, for example, the bear totem is extremely powerful. But you honor and respect all of the different creatures for that, whatever it is that makes them specifically unique, that brings them into the camaraderie of the life experience. But let's talk about the bear, because that means a lot to many different people. Why is the bear such a powerful symbol?
Well, I can share what I learned from the elders, from the Ojibwe elders in my area. And it's profound for me because, again, it's about all about relationship. It keeps coming back to relationship. The Ojibwe people here, and I found out through my studies with of indigenous people around the northern hemisphere, actually, wherever there are bears, there is this kinship, this human kinship with bears. They consider bears to be their closest relation. Bears are their brothers. And it's partly because there is a lot of physical similarity. Their paws, if you were to strip the fur off of the paw of a bear, the front paw of a bear, it looks very much like a human hand. Mm. And their footprints, the prints of their rear feet, look like a broad human foot. And they can stand up on their rear feet and walk on both feet. They don't do it often, but they can do it, especially when they're scared or they need to observe their area. They will stand on their back feet. And their diet is omnivorous. It's very similar to a hunter-gatherer human diet. In fact, Native people learned about a lot of the plants that are edible and the small animals that are edible by following bears around to see what they eat. So there's this close kinship, and the bear has become a medicine animal because the bears will eat certain medicine plants. If a bear is sick or wounded or constipated, my father-in-law gave me a story of a bear wounded. His shoulder was torn open, and he went down into a wetland where the clay was exposed, and the bear scooped up the clay and rubbed it on his wound. This was healing clay, and this is how the Native people learned about a lot of plants. When bears come out of hibernation in the springtime, they haven't had a bowel movement all winter, so they'll go and they'll look for certain plants to eat in order to get their systems functioning again. And in this way, the Native people learned about certain plants that can be used when people are constipated in order to get them going again.
Mm-hmm.
So here's this close relationship.
Would you stay with me for about another 15 minutes, Tamarack, because there's some other things regarding tracking and your book, Entering the Mind of the Tracker, that I would love to share with my audience. Would you be able to stay with me?
Oh, I'd be glad to.
Wonderful. We're going to take a break. This is Donna Sebald. We're listening to Tamarack's song, Entering the Mind of the Tracker. This book is a fascinating read. It's Native Practices for Developing Intuitive Consciousness and Discovering Hidden, I would like to say the hidden gifts of nature that are really out in the open if you're willing to look. We're going to come back in just a moment and share a few more things about how, well, if you're interested, you too can become a tracker. This is Donna Sebald. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebald, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-8255. 5604. You can also visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. My guest today is Tamarack Song, Entering the Mind of the Tracker. This book will take you into an awareness of how to listen to the environment you're in, no matter where you live. You could be in Burbank, California, Wisconsin, like Tamarack Song is. You could be in the Caribbean. You could be in the middle of Afghanistan. It wouldn't make any difference. It's being aware and listening. Tamarack, I was really fascinated with how you described being in the woods and it's raining. Of course, I live in the Pacific Northwest, and here it's raining right now. It's not unusual for the Seattle area.
Yeah.
But I found in your book a description about the different sounds that are made when it's raining by the different plants and trees. And you said there's a fifth that are from a maple leaf, the way the water comes off of it. You said, and you talk about the aspen and the birch, you say aspen leaves flutter and a birch does not. You're able to read the language of the plants, not just the animals, as a tracker. You call it a visual diorama painted by sound. Now, that to me was so expressive because that means you are going into a harmonic with your environment that is especially significant. I don't know that the average individual anywhere in this world gets to be that attuned to the sound of the plant world, the weather that's affecting it, the sounds that they make. It's no wonder you're such an excellent tracker. Who taught you to do this?
Well, the trees taught me. I remember going to an elder when I was younger, probably in my late teens, maybe early 20s, and asking a bunch of questions. I remember now, it was a Blackfoot elder. I was out hiking through the Northwest, coming back home, hitchhiking on Highway 2, I think, coming across the northern part of the country. And I stopped at the Blackfoot Reservation, and I was talking with some people, and they introduced me to a couple of elders. And I was full of questions, all these things I wanted to learn, I wanted to know about. Here's finally an Indian elder I can be with. And he turned to me after a while. He's very respectful, listened to me. And said essentially, this is in my words. I don't remember his exact words, but he said essentially, Tamarack, when you're talking, you're just repeating what you already know. Even when you're asking questions, you're asking what you think you should know. You don't leave any room for what is there for to know. When you're listening, it's the reverse. When you're listening, you're learning. And I felt ashamed. I could just see my cheeks flush. And I knew he intentionally aimed me. I just, at the time, he had to get me to stop. He had to get me to be self-reflective. He had to get to recognize what I was doing so that I could do something that was going to truly help me. He saw passion. He saw intent, my thirst. But he also saw the blockage that I had there. So from then on, I made a study of learning how to listen. It's so important. Now when I come into a group of new people, instead of trying to establish my identity and get to know people and talk, I'll stand there and I'll listen. I'll just listen so that I can pick up on the energy and the vibration of the place and get a sense of who the people are and why they came and get a feel for the relationship that's going on, the ongoing relationship, and then I'll gradually immerse myself in discussions or something.
Now, one of the things that you do as a tracker, you learned how to do this, and I just really think that the Blackfoot Elder just gave you such good wisdom, You say you like to go backward. You like to do backtracking. You learn more about animals and people, about who they are and what they're up to, and you learn it faster by finding out where they've come from rather than where they're going. And I thought, wow, that is so true. As a counselor, I find by listening and learning about what someone has experienced and gone through, it gives me an understanding of how perhaps they are not even aware of the tools they can utilize so that they can go forward, so that they can really do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And you incorporate that into so much of what you write about. And you go into information to, you know, about the different creatures, about the different bugs. But I really had to chuckle when I got to the chapter on spiders. I went, oh, my goodness, oh, boy. These are creepy, crawly critters that so frequently we are really paranoid about, because it is something that is very significant in our life, but yet they are so viable and they are so valuable in this world that we live in. How did you become comfortable with brother spider or sister spider? Because some of them can be pretty sassy.
That they can. That they can. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Spiders, bears, cougars, none of them are intrinsically our enemies. We make them our enemy by not understanding them. You know, I have a definition of fear that I can't repeat often enough, mainly for myself, but for other people too. Fear is just a lack of knowing. What we don't know, we fear. When we know and understand something, we can come into right relationship with that entity, whether it's the weather or an animal or another human being. We know how to take care of ourselves then. We're no longer victimized. We can be empowered. And the same with spiders. Spiders are just doing their thing. They're not out to bite us. They're not out to scare us. And if we know how to move in the rhythm of a spider in a spider's world, we can get along just fine with spiders. And that's what I did. And I came to realize in getting to know spiders that they're the wolves of the insect world. And it felt an instant kinship right away. They're stalkers. They're predators. They're very wise in terms of how they move. Watch a spider move. It's not like a typical insect. They're very graceful on their feet, just plodding along. Sometimes there are some spiders actually called wolf spiders, and they will run. Oftentimes you can see them scooting across the floor sometimes, or across a tree trunk. But spiders are mostly just walking very, very gingerly, and especially when they're stalking an insect. So I felt this real kinship with spider, and I have an episode in the book where I became a spider on my windowsill, and I was stalking this fly on the other, about maybe a foot away, and the spider took almost a half hour to very, very softly and gingerly stalk this fly so he wouldn't spook the fly and he could pounce upon it. He ended up missing the fly, but he didn't miss a beat. He just sat still again and waited for another fly to come by. And I learned a lot in that experience. What a beautiful example to emulate. The patience, the dedication, the focus, the sense of presence, the perseverance. It was all there. How can I look down on that spider? Boy, that spider's a teacher for me.
Well, and I think that's what the early people learned to do. When you think of different environments like the far north, where you have many, many months, where the hours of daylight are very short, where you have to hunt. You watch the fox, you watch the wolf, you watch up in Alaska the moose, the bear. There are all of these creatures, the caribou, that can teach you. You go into other parts of the world, you'll have here in the Pacific Northwest, we can have the badger, we have an abundance of deer, we have cougar, we have all kinds of creatures. And I find it so amazing, the adaptability of these animals within the environments of human beings and how they manage to hide themselves most of the time. You talk about, in your book, scat. Anybody that has read anything on tracking is very much aware of the poop trails of different animals and how they'll tell you stories and give you information. And all of this is very, very significant. And this is something that you bring out in the book, but you do more than that. You bring out the awareness of the plant environment. You talk about a feather being seen on top of a spider's web. That gives you information, how long it's been there, what kind of conditions have evolved. It also gives you information about time. And when I think of the old movies that were done, that I've watched, that were, let's say, done in the 40s or the 30s, whenever they represented the Indians, they would always say they could track this, they could track that, they could track the other. And I thought how little they really were able to define or give in those movies, because the Native Americans have lived within this environment for so long, to be able to track the animals allowed them to feed their people, to be able to integrate into the world that they lived in, understand its harmonics, enable them to survive. And life was pretty rugged. It was not an easy proposition. And I think your book brings out so much good information that can assist in the transformation that people in the so-called green movement really are looking for, but from a perspective that I don't think many people consider. Was that one of your objectives with this book, is to bring people's awareness to the value of all of the different forms of life and how we need to respect them so that we can bring the harmony back into the planet?
Yes. Yeah, you just said it. I should have asked you to write the introduction. That's great. That's beautiful. Yeah. You know, what I attempted to do here is to share through story. Stories are the original teachers. Before the printed word, before the recorded word, people would sit around and share their stories. The elders would tell their stories of times gone by, and the hunters and the trappers would come back from a day out in the field, the women who were gathering, and they tell stories about what they found, what they came across. There might be clues there. The kids and women might be out gathering firewood, and they might have seen a patch of berries that are getting ripe, or the mushrooms are coming up over on the north side of this hill, and they bring all these stories back. And here's where the clan knowledge comes in. If one person knows and sees something and tells the story, everybody knows and sees it. So here's where the richness comes in. The internet is a metaphor for that now, actually. Now we can go on the internet. If Wikipedia has it, we all have it, because we can all go there and share it. So this is the beauty of our indigenous ways, and this is what I'm attempting to share in this book, the power of story, bringing all of this together. You know, you probably experienced, many of you listeners, that if you're given a set of facts, you might or might not memorize them. You might not be able to recall them. However, if they're embedded in a story and you can recall the story, you not only have the facts, but you have the way to apply the facts, because the story gives you an example of how this knowledge can be used, how it can be utilized, and how it's worked for other people. So story is a very powerful way of teaching, and it's fun. Story's entertaining. You know, our movies
are
stories.
Well, we are out of time, Tamarack Song. It has been a joy having you as a guest. For those of you that really, really want to be intrigued with a subject matter that you probably in a million years would never consider that you could have an association with, Entering the Mind of the Tracker by Tamarack Song is awesome. You'll find out about an eagle spirit in the tin can. You'll find out about how bears teach you how you can learn the art of tracking, and there's so much more. Tamarack Song, what is your website that people can go to find out more about your book?
You can just go to tamaracksong.org.
TamarackSong.org. Check it out. It is an incredible publication, and one that I think will just awaken you just to your own environment in a new way, a new perspective that you had never experienced. Tamarack Song, it's been a delight having you as a guest. Thank you for being with me. We are taking a break, and we're going to be back in just a moment. This is Donna Sebo. Check out TamarackSong.com. We'll be right back.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Here in the Pacific Northwest, well, it's dribbling. We call it, I call it liquid gold, because that's what keeps us lush and green. But you'd never know that it was all that disturbing, because the hummingbirds are going around like crazy and just really enjoying themselves. But it's cool. There's this light mist that keeps going. I wanted to share some information with you. Oh, by the way, the phone lines are open, 888-627-6008. I received this email from a listener and a reader of my newsletter that comes out every month, and she wanted me to pass this information on. It came from a television website, KVAL. And this is information for those of you that have dogs and cats, as we do. You need to know that if your dog eats dry pet food, your cat too, you need to check the brand. Apparently, Natura Pet Products, N-A-T-U-R-A Pet Products, just expanded the recall of its dry foods for puppies, kittens, and adult dogs and cats. The company said that they have found salmonella bacteria in some of the foods during the time they did the tests at their plant. So this went out, and it was afterwards the testing found this. This recall involves five Natura brands: EVO, California Natural, Healthwise, Innova, and Karma. But a lot of other brands have been recalled recently. To make sure the pet food you have is free of contaminants, check the Food and Drug Administration's recall website and check it frequently, because the voluntary recalls don't always get publicity. So it happens. You may feed your animal, and we all know what happened not all that long ago with food that came in from China. In fact, I flatly refused to buy anything from China. And I'll tell you, I had an employee at a major store asked me when I was going to buy some particular dried chicken strips, and this lady asked me, are you aware that this comes from China? I said, no. She said, look at the package, and I did. She said, it's from China, and I'm letting people know that if you buy it from China, we've been getting reports. Buy the foods from China, you're getting reports about there being a contamination and animals having negative response to it. Put it right back, and I got another food snack product that was made in the USA. So be aware, if your animal has nausea, vomiting, fever, and diarrhea, if this comes on real fast, check the packaging. Make sure you know where the food is coming from. Of course, for my fur people, I always cook their food. I always prepare their food or give it to them raw, whichever they prefer, because I've been doing it for years. We've had Scotties, and our Scotties never did well on canned or dried food. Why? I don't know. Maybe they knew they were coming into the house where Mom was going to be fixing food, but I do. I cook their food, so everything is freshly prepared to the best of my capabilities, and it has shown to be a very good thing to do. But you may not be in a position to do that, so be aware. These brands, EVO, California Natural, HealthWise, Inova, and Karma, check the Food and Drug Administration's recall website regarding animal foods. So I just wanted to share that with you, and I want to thank Mary Ellen very much for passing that along. Donna Sebo here, 888-627-6008, if you'd like to chat. Next week, oh my goodness, have we got a fascinating lineup of people. We're going to be talking about Time Before Atlantis. Frank Joseph, who is a wonderful author. He's been on the show before, but he is a man loves history. Well, we're going to find out about some ancient history that maybe you didn't know anything about. Ray Arata is going to be with us. Wake up, man up, step up. Now, Ray is one of the few individuals that I've come across that actually likes to write about things from the perspective of men. And ladies, I think that this is important. This book has a lot of good information. And this is something, if you choose to read it, you may get an insight into the man's world that sometimes men aren't even aware of. And then, hello, taste good. Bye, guilt. Mm-hmm. Food, yes, glorious food. Howard Rosenthal, we're going to be chatting with him about good food, and I'm with him. Why do you want to have something that tastes like dried cardboard, for heaven's sakes? That's not necessarily healthy. Food is meant to be enjoyed. Then we're going to be talking with Karen Berg. Her book is titled To Be Continued. It's about reincarnation. And then Catherine Ravenwood. We are going to be talking about how to create sacred water. Now, I'm so sure you've heard about the scientist that found that water molecules changed structure in a most unusual way, and he was able to photograph it, ice crystals, all kinds of things. Well, we're going to be talking about that and more. And for those of you up in Alaska, I am going to be traveling up there. I'll be up in Alaska April the 29th through May the 6th. I'll be both in Fairbanks and Anchorage. So if you'd like to meet with me while I'm up in the far north, this is an opportunity to do so. So give me a call at my office, 253-582-5604. My goodness, the time just flies by. And Tamarack is a man whose life is involved with tracking. He has an understanding of nature that I just think is incredible. How many times have we wished that you had tracking experience, especially when you put your keys down somewhere that's not the normal place, and you can't find them to save your life. I mean, it just drives you nuts. Well, I think all of us do that. And if you don't want to lose anything again, there's a memory expert, Harry Lorraine, who says, your road to perfect recall begins with two words, original awareness. That means being present-minded, being aware of where you placed your item in the first place. And the best way to improve this original awareness attitude is use one object to help you to remember another. Let's say you put your eyeglasses down near a flower vase. To help you hardwire the memory of where you put your glasses, visualize a bouquet of eyeglasses growing out of the vase. That will keep the memory in your mind. This is Donna Sebo. It's been a delight sharing this time with you. I hope that you'll tell your friends about the show, but more than that, won't you join me again next week? We've got a fabulous lineup of people. And there's always a salt and peppering of various information and points that I like to think you enjoy. I love doing the show, and I love sharing the information with you. Join me. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is your life. Live it to the hilt, because this is your moment. You're making a difference. You're making a difference for me and for other people. Thank you for being with me today. I'll see you next week. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.